Welcome to Private Equity Perspectives, a podcast by BDO USA's private equity practice. Each episode, BDO connects with leaders in the private equity space to discuss the latest trends driving deal activity, fund strategies, and portfolio company optimization.
Hello, and welcome to BDO's Private Equity Perspectives podcast, where we explore the trends impacting private equity today. I'm Todd Kinney, National Relationship Director in BDO's Private Equity Practice. Today, we have a real privilege of being joined by Elliot Curlin, who's the co-founder and managing partner at Broadwing Capital, and Kyle Bethencourt, co-founder and managing partner at Sallyport. In this episode, Elliot and Kyle will discuss key market drivers impacting their approach to the 2025 deal-making landscape, how increased competition is impacting deal flow in 2026, and how they approach capital deployment when the market is tough. In part B of this episode, we'll explore how their firms are investing in and deploying AI assets, creative exit pathways resulting from really the long hold periods, and the biggest opportunities and challenges in PE for 2026. As always, just a quick reminder to our listeners that the remarks and opinions of our guests do not necessarily represent BDO's views. So with that out of the way, Kyle, I'm going to have you kick off the episode. So first, congrats on your inaugural fund at $160 million. Nice achievement there. Can you walk us through your path to co-founding Sallyport and what your current role entails and what differentiates Sallyport's investment approach?
Thank you, Todd, for having me on today. For everyone in the audience, my name is Kyle Bethencourt. I went to Texas A&M University, and when I graduated, I went to work for the El Paso Corporation, which is a large pipeline and E&P business. And that's where I met a gentleman named Doug Fauché, who became very instrumental in my career. Doug encouraged me to get an MBA, so I went to Wharton. And then when I graduated, I worked for a large hedge fund named D.E. Shaw, and then the Blackstone Group, which is a large private equity fund. And then in 2012, Doug sold El Paso to Kinder Morgan. And when that happened, he had a personal windfall, and he asked me to come start his family office. And I'll never forget my first day at Sallyport. I walked into this temporary office space. Doug wasn't there, and his assistant showed me into a room, and all that was in the room was a desk and a chair and a computer and a telephone. And there was no orientation and there was no instructions because we were starting from a complete blank slate. And if I'm honest, that was very daunting because I'd never been in that position before, but it's also great because it gave me plenty of time to think about how we should invest. And the first thing I thought about what I learned at Blackstone on investing, they had an efforts-based model where when we'd compete for a deal, we'd compete based off speed and rigor and a low cost of capital. And then I thought about Sallyport. We had a different type of money and we had a staff of one. So if we tried to compete on an efforts model, we were going to lose. So we came up with our own model on how to compete. And it was based off relationships, rigor, and thoughtfulness. And the results have been wonderful. 96% of our deals are proprietary to us. Our returns at the family office compared to a 2012 vintage private equity fund were top decile. But what I'm most proud of is we built a platform of compounding success so that every year that went by, we had a higher and higher likelihood of making money. And recently, Doug came up to me and my colleague, Ryan Howard, and said, Kyle, I think you'll have more talent than I have money. I want to seed a private equity fund for you. And that's how Sallyport Partners Fund got started. We raised a fund, we came in oversubscribed, and we have a very wide mandate. But our core focus is on specialty finance, manufacturing, logistics, and infrastructure services.
All right, Kyle. Well, that's a great story. So we're excited to have you on. So, Elliot, I'll give you the chance to share the same. You co-founded Broadwing in 2022 after 17 years at your previous firm. Perhaps you can tell our listeners a bit about your current role, what prompted the move, and what makes Broadwing's approach unique in the lower middle market.
You bet. Sure. Thanks. Thanks for having me on, Todd. Actually, like Kyle, I'm a fighting Texas Aggie as well, so this is fun to be on together. So just over 3 years ago, I launched Broadwing with my longtime partner, Andrew Boisseau. Andrew and I worked together, as you mentioned, in our previous firm on a number of transactions together and separately, and had a vision for how we could continue to build on our very operational approach to private equity that's focused on the lower middle market. We tend to look at companies with 5 to 15, 20 million of EBITDA, and we'll go a little bigger as well, but we're happy to build value. And we really think of ourselves as platform builders, but we also are investing in the company's cultures and employees and the communities where they operate. And that's where our mantra comes from, enhancing companies' cultures and communities. We found that if we're intentional about those last two parts up front, we can make an impact even while we build terrific platforms and generate returns for our investors. Our model is really built upon our shared experience together. In fact, I've been in middle market private equity, working with manufacturing and services companies since 2000. And that's where we've really focused our efforts. After getting an MBA at Harvard, I came back to Texas to work with a very operational private equity fund where we were the operational team, as well as the investing team. And at Broadwing, we've managed to separate the team a little bit so we can have returns to expertise. We're working with operators. In some cases, we've known for 15 plus years, known and worked with them at portfolio companies through the Great Recession. And so we have a deep, deep operational bench who can partner with and collaborate with company management teams. And we have an investment team that's looking to find opportunities where we can invest beside selling families, founders, owner-operators of companies that generally are not in a broad marketing process. 82% of our opportunities that we source are founder or family owned. And that's where we really have an opportunity to shine with our values-driven and operational approach to investing.
All right, Elliot. Well, it's great to have you on. Now that everyone is more familiar with what you both do, let's dig into some larger topics. Last year was full of unexpected events that shocked the industry. As you reflect on 2025, what were the key market drivers that impacted deal uncertainty? Also, how did factors like geopolitical uncertainty, interest rate environments, and macroeconomic volatility shape the landscape and influence your approach? And really, feel free to highlight anything you learned from these headwinds that you're taking into 2026. Elliot, why don't you get us started here?
Sure. So it's certainly an interesting year. And I think, you know, anytime there's political uncertainty, that can serve as a little bit of a dampener on investment activity, deal activity in the lower middle market. It doesn't shut it down, but it's always nice to know whose policies are going to be in effect. And coming in the, you know, out of the end of 2024 into 25, that question seemed to have gotten solved, right? We knew that right. Donald Trump is going to be the president. What we didn't necessarily expect was all of the tariff activity. And I think as we were going into that April, May timeframe, you were starting to see a lot of deal activity picking up. There's still a very large capital overhang of private equity capital, private credit capital that was looking to be deployed in attractive deals. And you'd seen depressed deal activity for the prior couple of years due to other reasons, right? More macroeconomic, still coming out of COVID, supply chain issues, interest rates, et cetera. So it seemed like deal activity in 2025 was poised to pick up. I think at least in a number of industries where supply chains, large component parts or inputs that were coming from overseas, there was a cloud of uncertainty over that. And it wasn't just China, Asia sourcing. It was also North America for a while, right? And of course, Europe as well. And so that didn't necessarily stop deal activity. I think it created new concerns that had to be addressed. For example, we're looking at a company in the distribution space back in March, April of last year, right as the tariffs came out, as Liberation Day happened. And what it meant is that we slowed our discussions. We said, let's see what shows up in the numbers. How do we deal with this? Are we able to pass through price increases? Do we need to take some margin compression? Are we even able to access product, right? And by we, I mean this company we were talking to that we were hoping to partner with. And in the fall, having had the benefit of 5 or 6 months of actual numbers and experience, we were able to continue our discussions and are now getting to the tail end of that process, hopefully with them, for an investment. So I think it slowed things. I don't think it necessarily chilled everything, but there were big
Right.
questions that had to be answered. And then if you overlay some of the global conflicts on top of that, that continued, and perhaps with other saber rattling, maybe took more concerns coming out of the end of the year. I think you see certain industries that are positioning and capital flowing to that, particularly obviously on the A&D side, but also in communications, other things that could help with national security. Cybersecurity seems to be a hot sector as well. So I think deal activity numbers did pick up, but it was despite an early cloud of uncertainty that we had to get through.
Yeah. Well, Kyle, what's your point of view on some of the macro factors of 2025? When you look back on the year, how did they influence your approach, and what did you learn from them for 2026?
Well, Todd, I think 2025 was a pretty wild year.
Yeah.
Liberation Day put everything on pause. And then the debates around interest rates always make a big difference in things. But fortunately for the Sallyport Partners Fund, we were a brand new fund. So we had plenty of money to deploy. And we had no legacy portfolio companies that we really had to manage. So this allowed us to focus on industry trends and to focus on very specific opportunities. And in the family office, we invested in a company alongside another family office. We started it together, and it became our first portfolio company of the fund because they needed growth capital. They provide working capital solutions to whiskey and bourbon businesses, and it's been red hot. It currently owns over 140,000 barrels of whiskey and bourbon. Its 2-year cumulative EBITDA is over $30 million. So
Wow.
it's performing very well. But when you talk about macro trends in that industry, there's a macro trend, and people call it the lake of whiskey. There's an oversupply. And so our focus was on how to help this great, successful company navigate that risk, how to capture some of the opportunities that we're developing because of it, and how to help our customers and potential customers navigate through this scenario as well. So we had a lot of fun with that, and it's going very well.
It sounds like it's going well. Thanks, Kyle. Let's switch over to our next topic. I want to discuss deal volume in 2026. Kyle, I'll come to you first. Can you speak a bit about how you put money to work in an environment where the market is tight and capital deployment has been challenging?
Yes. So at Sallyport, we think that good deal flow makes for good investors. So if you have a lot of deal flow, it allows you the luxury of when a bad deal comes in, you can pass on it immediately. If a good deal comes in, you can pass on it immediately. When a very good deal comes in, you can kind of pick it up off the conveyor belt, set it to the side, and study it for a little while. But the real secret in the investing world is you don't have to be a professional investor to recognize an exceptional deal. And the exceptional deals are never going to make it past the first person that gets to see them. So at Sallyport, we do everything we can to be helpful, to be caring, and to be kind, and to make good friendships with others so that when the exceptional deals come, we get to see them first. And I think I said this before, 96% of our deals have been proprietary. And that's a big advantage to us. But sometimes the market gets hot and the things you want get bid up. So when we have an investment thesis that we can't implement through buying a company that already exists, we will do something a little bit different. And we call that our studio model. And that's when we will write a business plan. And we will commit the capital and we'll go out and hire a management team and start a business from scratch. And when people hear me say this, they usually say, Kyle, that sounds so risky. But we always do this in industries that don't require a lot of CapEx and where we can find a management team that already knows all the employees and they already know all the customers they want to deal with. And so we look at it as more of a synthetic acquisition. We've done this 7 times now. The first time we did it was in a portfolio company of ours. They were an accounts receivable factoring business. And we started in 2014. We built it up. We sold it in 2024, made almost 10 times our money on the deal. And it's a perfect example of what we like to do in our studio model.
I'll tell you, this is episode 55. I don't think we've ever had a guest on, and we've had hundreds that had the studio model. So that's pretty interesting. Appreciate the color there. So, Elliot, what about Broadwing? I'm wondering, with the strategics also ramping up competition for quality assets, how is that playing out in your deal flow, both on the buy side and exits?
It's a great question, and it's a real consideration and market trend because we are seeing strategics, particularly with stock prices where they are and with economic activity where it is, looking to buy. What's a little bit more unique is we have a lot of strategics looking in our space and coming down market. There's also been a trend recently where some larger funds have started looking into the lower middle market as well, as competition for deals has ramped up. And so we've started smaller. As I mentioned, that lower end of our range, 5 million of EBITDA, is very real. We still are seeking to grow platforms that would have over 20 million, 30 million of EBITDA when we exit, but we're just starting a little bit smaller. And so far, that strategy has been working for us. We've been investing in companies now for the last 2.5 years, done 14 acquisitions over that time frame. Last year, that broke down one new platform and eight add-on investments. Add-on investing is a great way to build scale strategically, new geographies, new customers, new products that we want to have that strengthen our portfolio companies as a business. We also are very interested in growing organically, whether that's new products, organic sales engines, or looking at greenfield location growth. So, services or even manufacturing. We had two plant capacity expansions last year where we almost doubled those plant footprints because of the organic growth in the business. And so we're looking at different ways to try and pursue growth that would be attractive to strategics when we exit. But there's obviously a lot of folks looking for good companies right now. And so we've had to really emphasize our deep and relatively extensive investing pedigree, our operational approach, right, where we're partnering to help with growth, not just giving them capital, right? It seems like today you need to be more than just a source of capital. There needs to be some value that you add. And we're trying to be very focused in how we source. So thematic investing is a big part of our approach. We go deep on industries based on our advisors, our prior experience, where we think we can find value. Then we really scour the universe in that sector, trying to find that right platform that's excited about our vision and what we're trying to build together.
Well, I appreciate all that, Elliot. Certainly sharing some good insight for our listeners. But for now, we're going to press pause on this discussion. But don't worry, we'll hear more from Elliot and Kyle in a couple weeks. On the next episode, we'll discuss lessons learned from the 2021 buying frenzy, their plans for AI this year, and what creative exit pathways their companies may explore. So, Elliot and Kyle, until part B, I thank you both for making time for the podcast today, and I'm looking forward to our next conversation.
Sounds great. Thank you, Todd.
Yep.
Thank you.
Yep. To our listeners, thanks so much for tuning in. If you haven't already, we'd love for you to subscribe, rate, and leave a review of the show wherever you get your podcasts. Until next time, this has been BDO's Private Equity Perspectives.
The views presented by our guests do not necessarily reflect the views of their respective firms.